We all want to do the right thing, right? Well, it's complicated.
It's not a book about larger-than-life characters who vanquish injustice to resounding music and applause. It's really more a novel about how hard it is not only to do the right thing, but to even know what the right thing is.
That's Charlotte Rogan. We talk with her about her new novel, Now and Again. It's about an ordinary woman who becomes inspired to take on the fight against social ills she sees around her, and what that means for the people she loves. Then, the Black Lives Matter movement has largely focused on black men. But what about black girls in school?
Black girls in particular are vulnerable to a type of punishment and discipline that really does present them with the possibility of being pushed out of school, especially given how important it is for girls to stay in school if we want to maintain them as a community that has a reduced contact with the criminal and juvenile legal system.
That's Monique Morris. We talk with her about her groundbreaking book, Push Out, The Criminalization of Black Girls in Schools. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice. Thanks for joining us this hour on this station and at writersvoice.net. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon. Have you noticed how much scorn is heaped on idealism these days? It's unrealistic, say the pundits. Mature people are pragmatic. Or, as Obama likes to say, don't make the perfect the enemy of the good. But how's pragmatism working out for you? Millions of Americans are looking at plummeting living standards, endless wars, mass imprisonment, and a poisoned environment, and saying, so where's the good we were promised? And as the enormous crowds who thronged Bernie Sanders' stump speeches can tell you, a whole lot of people want to give idealism a chance. The Sanders movement woke people up to the realities of power and the erosion of democracy. And despite his endorsement of Hillary Clinton, many are not exactly meekly rejoining the establishment fold. Once the blinkers came off, they couldn't unsee what they had been shown. Something similar happens to the protagonist of Charlotte Rogan's terrific new novel, Now and Again. Maggie Rayburn's contented life as a wife, mother, and secretary at a munitions plant is shaken when she finds proof of a high-level cover-up at her job. One thing leads to another, and soon Maggie is involved in a high-stakes fight against injustice that puts her and her family at risk. She's faced with a choice: risk all or silence her conscience. Rogan's book explores the responsibilities we have to ourselves, our families, and our larger world, and the moral territories we traverse in fulfilling them. Now and Again is Charlotte Rogan's second novel. Her first was The Lifeboat. Charlotte Rogan, welcome to Writer's Voice. This novel, Now and Again, is very much about the moral choices we face in life. The protagonist is, on the surface, an ordinary woman who works at a munitions plant. It's Maggie Rayburn. Tell us about Maggie.
Well, Maggie is a longtime wife, mother, and secretary at this munitions plant. And she has a very kind of ordinary and predictable life, and her life, she assumes, is secure until she finds, on the first or second page of the novel, she finds a proof of a high-level cover-up on her boss's desk, and she impulsively takes it. And this is an act that turns her world, but really more importantly, her worldview, completely upside down. And then she's faced with those moral choices of what she is going to do with this information.
Now, I know we don't want to give things away, but do you want to say a little bit about the topic or the issue that this paper refers to?
Yes. The paper refers to the fact that the munitions that are being made in this plant are toxic, and they're toxic not only to the workers who are making them, but they're also toxic to the soldiers who use them in war. And this fact is being covered up by the government and the people who run the munitions plant.
And why do you think she takes it? What is that impulse that moves her?
Well, she has received, sometime before this moment, she's received a letter asking about, are there any, any documents that talk about this, the toxicity, because there's someone else who's been looking into this. She's a midwife. Her name is Dolly. And Dolly has seen evidence of birth defects in the town. And so she's very interested in sort of tracking down why are these birth defects happening. Dolly works with veterans and veterans' wives. And so she's just started to open her eyes about things that are going on in the world. So Maggie has received a letter from Dolly, but she has no intention of answering it. And it's just in the back of her mind when she then does see the document. So I think that's what's fueling the impulse. I think there's also Maggie's, it's her 39th birthday, and I think she is just ready for something new. So there's also an element of excitement in sort of doing things that are a little bit underhanded or a little bit, you know, outside the bounds of her normal life. So she's sort of on that cusp of her awareness has been sharpened by the letter she's received, but she's also ready for something to change.
And she reminded me of other real women who have emerged out of their working class life, their ordinary life, people like Lois Gibbs, people like Erin Brockovich, who, you know, discovered something going on and became activists and also became much larger, you know, human beings in their scope of life than they had been before.
Right. And I think Maggie's view of the world changes. She comes from a very small town in Oklahoma, and that's been her world up until this point. And she is aware that there's a lot of the world out there that she's never seen. But you're right, she does, once her eyes are opened and deciding what to do. Now, Erin Brockovich we think of as a larger-than-life superhero almost in, you know, the mythology that surrounds her. And Maggie isn't quite like that. She's more ordinary, and she does change and evolve over the course of the book, but it's not a book about larger-than-life characters who vanquish injustice to resounding music and applause. It's really more a novel about how hard it is not only to do the right thing, but to even know what the right thing is.
Could you say more about that?
Yeah, I guess that one of the things that really motivated me in writing, and after the book was done, and that's when I think, at least for me, and this is probably true of other writers, that's when you try to figure out what it was you were writing about all this time anyway. And as I sat and I tried to answer that question of what was my motivation for writing, it started off very simple. There was a point back in 2004 when I read a blog post written by a man who had decided to quit his job at a munitions plant because he didn't support the war in Iraq. That was just the thing that got me going. But later I realized that it, as important as that, and maybe even more important, was an inquiry into the way information affects our lives in this day and age. I didn't pick the story up, and I didn't really get going on it for real until about 2013. And by that time, information in our lives was big news. There was WikiLeaks going strong. There was Chelsea Manning convicted of espionage for disclosing a lot of sensitive and secret documents. And Edward Snowden was opening his Pandora's box of secrets about the NSA. And so this whole idea that Maggie was now going to get some information that was comparable to what some of these other guys had gotten access to and what you do with it, that was in the ether around me as I wrote. So the whole idea of information and, you know, not only that it's, you know, there's a lot that we don't know or that's being kept from us, but there's so much out there. It's sort of overwhelming. What do you actually do with it, and how do you know what's real, what's fabricated, what's outright lies? So Maggie finds herself in that kind of situation vis-a-vis information.
And it seems like she's very much guided by an inner sense of justice, something more than, you know, applying logical thinking. I mean, she trusts her intuition.
She does. And I also, I mean, there's sort of a scene in the book that I think is not a spoiler because it's not a plot point, but there is that scene in the book or that part of her life where she goes to Phoenix looking for Sandra Day O'Connor. And on a very simple level, you can say, well, that's her looking for justice, and she never really finds it. And I think that that's true in life, is that we're looking for these big idealistic things, and rarely do we find them. But not being motivated by idealism doesn't really make you more realistic. It just makes you directionless. So Maggie is tapping into her sense of idealism that there are things wrong, and she, you know, she's going to set out to change them if she can. How realistic that is and how successful she's going to be is open to question. But I do think it does give her life this direction that she had been lacking.
You know, it almost reminds me of the, you know, the epithet that was flung at Bernie Sanders for being idealistic, and his supporters are being idealistic as opposed to pragmatic. What do you think of that that dichotomy or that contrast?
No, I think that's very interesting, and I think that we would all be poorer without idealism in our lives. You can't expect that the world will be peaceful, for instance, but should we not shoot for peace? And I don't think you can expect that true justice will prevail, but should we not shoot for true justice? So I think all those things, I think I've never, I guess, heard idealism used as a derogatory remark. I think of it as something very positive. But I guess you could, I guess I have heard it, you know, pie in the sky idealism. I guess I have heard that. But I think that we all need idealism in our lives.
Idealism comes when you have an epiphany of how the world is. And that's very much, it seems, what happens to Maggie, that her worldview shifts. Once she kind of sees through the official story, she understands the relationships of power that underlie that.
Right. And I do think that once people's eyes are opened, they can't live in the same way. And either, I mean, you have a couple choices. You keep your eyes opened and your life has to change, or you shut them again. You decide you can't deal with it. You don't know what to do. Peter Singer does a lot of writing about how technology has changed. Technology and globalization have changed the nature of responsibility. Now that we know about all of these problems out there, what do we then do about them? And it's a very nice idea to think that mere awareness is all it takes, or all it should take, for people to change their lives and to do what it takes to help people who need it. But there's also another writer that I was reading about, a guy named Paul Slovic, who he says that there's something called statistical numbing that kicks in. Mm-hmm. The minute your awareness, you become aware of people, the number that triggers statistical awareness is anything greater than one. So that's why a picture of a child washed up on a beach is so effective. But ledgers and statistics of thousands in dire straits or dying fail to move us. So there's that whole sense of how what do we do with all of this information? And I think that this information overload, which is a big problem today, as everything, our inboxes are just filled with petitions to be signed or causes to donate to, people who need to be saved. And I think a lot of us do shut down in the face of that.
Yeah, and Maggie doesn't. Now, you have other people in her life, her husband and son, Lyle and Will. What happens to her begins a process of shifting and change in her personal relationships. You know, Lyle seems like a really good guy, but he seems also a bit left in the dust.
And I think he sort of started in the dust and he stayed there. He didn't really grow as a person. And he, in his relationship with Maggie, I think relied on her to call a lot of the shots and to organize the family and to make things work. Once she shifts her focus away from the family to, you know, things outside of her community, that leaves Lyle and Will to kind of, you know, reinvent themselves or make decisions they've never had to make before. And this is another thing about duty, and again, Peter Singer, who writes about these expanding circles of duty. There's the inner circle of your family, and then there are the outer circles progressing through your community and your state and your country to the world. Where does your duty lie? By focusing on an outer circle, you're necessarily going to neglect an inner one. And so that dynamic comes into play in the book as well, is where does duty lie? And you can't do everything. So Maggie's focus, when that shifts, it does have consequences for her family.
You take up a lot of issues here, not just the issue of war, because we also haven't talked about the whole other plot. There are really two plots here, and we'll talk about the other one in a minute. But, you know, she leaves the munitions plant and she goes to work in a prison, into a privately run prison, and confronts the moral choices there. I found this part of the book. Well, I mean, this was a terrific read all the way through, but this part of the book was very moving, how she wrestles with the way prisoners are seen and how she can work her way towards a sense of justice, overcoming the stereotypical relationships between staff and inmates.
Right, and I think a lot of these small towns, like they do tend to only have a few industries, and one of the industries that's popping up in small towns that have lost other means of making a living are these private prisons. So, you know, the people who live in the towns don't have a lot of options for where they can work, but she sort of sees that there's an opportunity to maybe do some good by going to work in the prison, and she starts off quite small by working in the prison school, but her eyes are opened again to the fact that there's much injustices surrounding incarceration, not only for people who are innocent, but maybe people who have committed very minor crimes.
Yeah, and you hit a lot of bases. I mean, even the use of slave labor in prisons, which I think is just something that people are just beginning to get aware of, how much labor is done in major corporations like, you know, Microsoft. I mean, many corporations that are being done by prisoners who are basically slave labor.
Correct. And one thing about hitting all those bases, and I meant to just get at that whole sense of information overload, that there are a lot of bases to be hit, and how do you even begin to attempt to solve some of the problems? So Maggie does kind of ricochet around a little bit in terms of where to focus her energies, but I think that's true in the world of where do you even begin with some of these things that have really gone off track. And part of it, too, is not so much about any specific injustice. It's a lot of it is about just what happens when a person does open their eyes and does start to get involved and does want to change things. I mean, it's very difficult to know, as I said before, where your duty lies, but also then how to affect this big monolith of, you know, kind of the way things are, the way things have evolved in this country, but even in the world. How do you change things? How does one person change things?
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with Charlotte Rogan about her new novel, Now and Again. I mean, it does seem that we've really lost our moral core.
You know, and I think that the moral core probably exists in the people, because I think most people do have a moral center, and I think most people do want to do the right thing. It's just that when you get systems that sort of almost take on a life of their own, how do you change those?
And, you know, one thing is, in the novel, I mean, Maggie plays a role in changing the people around her. I mean, I love this. There's a certain part where, you know, the other people in her small town start asking, what would Maggie Rayburn do?
Yeah, they do, because they start to look at her as someone who is sticking up for something that's beyond herself, some moral principle. The other thing, when you kind of talk about the two plot lines, and we can get to the one about the soldiers, I have gotten questions from people who've read the book of why those two plot lines don't intersect more. And one thing that I was getting at is that in this day and age, and in this particular Iraq war, we were very much encouraged. If you weren't part of the military, you were encouraged to ignore it, to not, you know, we weren't allowed to see pictures of flag-draped coffins, for instance. So the only way in the real world that the two worlds, the worlds of the civilians and the worlds of the military, overlapped was if you had a relative in the service, then of course your worlds overlapped. And the second way was through information. And so, you know, there is a website that develops, and there are mechanisms for these documents, such as the ones Maggie finds, to kind of find their way out into the greater public. But that's the way that people like me became aware of what was really going on in the war, was through, you know, this information web that's around us. And it can be overwhelming, but it can also be very informative. And so those were sort of the two ways that the plot lines intersect, except until the end when they kind of come together.
Yeah, but they're very much both about confronting moral choices.
Yes, thematically. Thematically, yeah. Yes, they do intersect. Plot-wise, they're a little more separate.
Yeah, and you have, Penn Sinclair, who is a captain, and his men who are in Iraq, and there is a terrible accident. There are some major injuries. Talk a little bit about Penn Sinclair and the choices that he faces.
And Penn Sinclair, he is someone who, in this war situation, he has to decide, based on the information that he has, which is limited, partial, some of it may be out and out false, but he has to decide whether or not to send a convoy through this very dangerous territory. And there's a big downside. If he doesn't send it, then the soldiers on the other end don't get the supplies that they need. If he does send it, he's putting soldiers in harm's way. So that's the situation he's confronted with at the beginning of the book. Later, he comes home from Iraq, convinced himself that he made the wrong choice that day. Whether or not it's wrong, we don't know. We just know that some bad things happened because of it, but bad things might have happened anyway. This was a war. But he comes home determined to make things right in some way, and he gets together with some of the survivors to tell the truth about the war. But then that opens the whole question of what is the truth about the war. And what they decide is that the truth is all the stories together, everybody's story, whether or not each person's perspective is correct or adequate or anything like that. But if you just put all that information out there on a website, on the internet, a picture will emerge that will at least approximate truth. And so that's sort of what they set out to do.
Hmm. Yeah, it also seemed like a theme here is ordinary people piercing through the veil of the official story and then, you know, having to confront the consequences of that. You know, that the story, you know, this whole Noam Chomsky talks about manufactured consent, and I think we're seeing in this current presidential campaign, this primary, how much the establishment is actually panicking at the way in which hundreds of thousands of ordinary people are beginning to wake up to the story behind the story, the reality behind the story, and are desperately trying to control the message through the corporate media. You know, it seems like this was also a story about ordinary people waking up to the reality around them and beginning to take action because they see themselves liberated by their own understanding.
Yes, and that there again is that's where information can help us.
You know, I wanted to ask you, there is a question that's posed but not answered in the book, and I wanted to see if you would be willing to kind of complete the sentence. You know, I'll just quote from the book. There's only one meaningful philosophical question. One character says, you know, the professor, he says, that there's only one meaningful philosophical question. It's whether it's possible to be both moral and...
Now, you know, when I left that blank, I do have an answer that I will tell you, but I also like the idea of people trying to fill in their own answers. I would say whether it's possible to be both moral and alive. But wow. I think there's other ways to answer that question. That was my initial answer to that, but I didn't want to say it because as I was doing that, I thought, you know, there are probably other, maybe even better answers to this. Let me leave it up to the readers to fill in whatever they might think. I say alive because I think all of us, wittingly or unwittingly, do bad things, or bad things are done in our name and we benefit. And I will just use a very stupid example, but every day of my life, I throw away tons of plastic. Mm-hmm. It makes me crazy. Why am I doing this? Mm-hmm. But everything's wrapped in plastic that I buy. They put it in more plastic for me to take home. And all of those things that I kind of think, oh my gosh, it's going straight into the oceans, and mm-hmm. it's, you know, a big dead zone the size of Texas, and, you know, why am I not finding another way to go about this? But it's a lot easier to just go to the supermarket and buy what they have there, you know, already prepared. And so that's just one small example, but it's not a good thing that I'm doing that. And I think all of our lives are, you know, we can say that, okay, I live in this nice community and I have most of my needs taken care of. Well, why? Is it a matter of luck, or is it a matter that someone somewhere on my behalf made choices that were very bad for someone else, ended up good for me, but not good for someone else? So I think no matter what, there's if it's not a zero-sum game, it's sort of something approximating that, where as much as we might try to leave the world a better place than we found it, I'm just not sure it's possible.
And yet I would like to challenge that for a minute, because I've thought also, I'm sure many of us have thought of those very same things. In fact, the very same example that you gave was one I was just thinking about yesterday. And that is that ultimately, though, the moral choice is the only one that is sustainable in terms of the survival of our civilization, possibly of the human race, certainly of the many creatures and ecosystems upon which we depend. So that maybe in the short term, we see this as a contradiction, but in the long term, if we don't adopt that sense of interconnectedness, we're doomed.
No, I can see what you're saying. So you're taking a step back and reversing my question. So, yeah, so I've maybe made some assumptions that once you get rid of those, yes, you won't be alive if you don't make the moral choice. So that's a very good point. I like that.
Well, this was absolutely a terrific read. I loved this book. Now and again, Charlotte Rogan, I want to thank you so much for talking with us here about it. It's been great to talk with you.
Well, thank you so much for having me on your show, and it's been nice to meet you.
Read an excerpt from Now and Again at writersvoice.net. Next up, the criminalization of black girls at school. Stay tuned after the break.
I'd sing more about more of this land, but all God's children ain't free. I'd open up every door I can, 'cause all God's children ain't free. I met a beaten, broken man. He shovels dirt but got no land, and he held out his hand to me. All God's children ain't free.
Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. The tragic toll of police violence on the lives of young black men has been much in the news lately. But there's another slow-motion tragedy that we hear very little about: the disproportionate numbers of black girls being pushed out of school and into the prison pipeline. Their lives are also being destroyed by zero tolerance policies, racist indifference to their educational needs, and an epidemic of sexual assault. Take the case of 15-year-old Diamond. She stopped going to school when she was expelled for lashing out at peers who constantly teased her for something everyone on the staff had missed. She was being trafficked for sex. After months on the run, she was arrested and sent to a detention center for violating a court order to attend school. That's just one of many stories social justice scholar Monique Morris unearthed over 4 years of research for her book, Push Out. It chronicles the experience of black girls across the country whose lives are misunderstood by teachers, administrators, and the justice system, and degraded by the very institutions charged with helping them flourish. Yet despite these obstacles, black girls still find ways to breathe remarkable dignity into their lives in classrooms, juvenile facilities, and beyond. Morris gives voice to them and charts the path towards nourishing these children instead of throwing them away. Well, Monique Morris, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Thank you for having me on.
This book, Push Out, is such an important book, pointing to an issue that really is underreported in the media: the criminalization of black girls in schools, and that is your subtitle of the book. In the first pages of the book, you list a couple of cases that made it, that did make it into the media.
Mm-hmm.
In 2013, a 16-year-old diabetic girl in Alabama fell asleep during an in-school suspension, was ordered to leave the classroom, and as she was leaving, a police officer slammed her face into a file cabinet, and she got arrested. And then there are black girls as young as 6 or 7 who are arrested for throwing tantrums in kindergarten. How typical are cases like this, and how do they signal the systematic push out of black girls from schools?
Thank you for framing that in that way. You know, I think it's very easy for us to look at some of the most egregious cases involving school push out or the use of exclusionary discipline, the suspensions, the expulsions, and the violence enacted against girls, you know, as something that either does not occur often or that is so anomalous that we can disregard it. And, you know, I put them in the book and I string them together because it's important for us to understand that while they do represent, you know, an egregious enactment, so they're not super typical, you know, to have girls assaulted in this way consistently every day. But they do occur, and they occur among black girls more often than they occur among other girls. And also, they signal, you know, when I talk about school-to-confinement pathways or what most people understand to be the school-to-prison pipeline, you know, I talk about not just the policies and practices that facilitate this school push-out and criminalization that occurs in schools, but I also talk about a prevailing consciousness that does render girls, black girls in particular, vulnerable to the type of punishment, the type of violent and sexual victimization that renders them vulnerable to contact with the criminal and juvenile legal system later in life. So these cases, while they do stand out, you know, sort of in the public, or they have been able to reach the masses, if you will, in a way that allows people to understand what might be happening in schools, they are a signal in many ways of the prevailing consciousness. They're a reflection of the consciousness that has rendered black girls vulnerable to this type of abuse in schools, as well as to the erasure of their experiences in the public discourses about safety.
So say more about that consciousness. How are black girls perceived by the dominant culture?
Yeah, it's not even just by the dominant culture. So I talk a bit in the book about, you know, I sort of build on W.E.B. Du Bois's articulation of black identity through this concept of double consciousness, which he wrote about in 1903. And he talks a bit about how black people have always needed to struggle with reconciling their identity as black people as well as Americans. And what I offer in this space, really drawing from the scholarship, the, you know, radical black feminist scholarship around identity, is understanding, too, that gender is a third identity that never goes away. It's one that's extremely visible, and it's one in its, you know, sort of representation publicly that informs how black women are engaged and black girls are engaged by the public. So, you know, in the public mind, there is, you know, or in the sort of a collective consciousness, there's this way in which black femininity is presented as hypersexual or loud, sassy, conniving, and these are ideas that inform how adults engage with girls. And when girls are not behaving in a manner that is consistent with some of our normed ideas about what constitutes a good girl, quote-unquote, you know, black girls in particular are vulnerable to a type of punishment and discipline that really does present them with the possibility of being pushed out of school. And that's what I'm interrogating here, especially given how important it is for girls to stay in school if we want to maintain them as a community that has a reduced contact with the criminal and juvenile legal system. Having an education reduces the likelihood of being in contact with the justice system in significant ways. And so if we know that, why are we trying to push girls out?
Tell us now, how did you get interested in this? It's a very passionately written book. It's a wonderful book and a powerful one. So how did you get involved in this issue?
much of it was informed by my own consciousness, just having been at one time a black girl, now a black woman, and understanding the public gaze and the way in which black femininity was misunderstood by the public and misunderstood by adults who were in educational positions. But really what I noticed, really in the mid-1990s, when I was engaging in conversations about criminalization and advancing my own education, I noticed that, number one, most of the conversations that were happening about youth in the justice system were focused primarily on boys. Mm-hmm. And that while that was reflective of their dominance in institutions, they are absolutely overrepresented in carceral facilities, there was always a girls' wing, and there was always a group of girls who were in these facilities and whose needs were not necessarily being met. And about 15 years ago, actually almost 16 years ago now, I had written a street novel that looked at prostitution, and it told a fictional story about very real issues in our communities, about girls who were commercially sex trafficked. And I had the opportunity to go in and talk to some of the young girls and older girls in facilities. And in one facility in particular, there was a very, very young girl. I talk about her in the book, you know, who really just woke me up. And it's not that I was asleep, because I definitely saw the girls that were in there, but she was so young. She was 11 years old and had already been commercially sex trafficked. And the way that she referred to herself and the absence of any rigorous discussion about re-engaging her in school was just heartbreaking. And so I think it's been very important in our, you know, public consciousness to bring attention to the forgotten needs of girls. And the more I have seen conversations emerge and grow about interrupting the school-to-prison pipeline, I started to notice, along with several other colleagues, that we needed to bring girls intentionally into this space if we were actually going to interrupt these cycles, given that they are sharing the surveillance, sharing schools, sharing the criminalization alongside many boys. So that is really what brought me into this space.
That 11-year-old, you call her Denisha, so powerful. She introduces herself to you as an 11-year-old and a hoe.
Exactly.
And you go into a lot of the background to it. It's a very, I'd say, a multidimensional treatment that you give on sex trafficking of black girls, first starting with how black women are viewed as hypersexual, and also talking about all the different factors that push girls, young girls, into prostitution and out of school. I wonder if you could talk about that multifactorial picture now.
You know, I'd like to start in that space by addressing the what I call the priming of black girls for their own victimization. I have now had an opportunity to talk about the book in different cities around the country, and it's very interesting to me how there is still, you know, very much a strong oral tradition in the black community. And there are songs that girls sing on playgrounds and yards, and it, you know, follows the patty cake rhythms and, you know, the sort of playful ways in which girls share and exchange information. And, you know, one of the things that I offer at the beginning of each chapter is a little epilogue that is an excerpt from some of those songs. And there are many ways in which the songs themselves reflect an internalized oppression and an internalized way in which girls understand that at some point in their lives they may have to sell their bodies, or they may be requested to interrogate their own opportunity to live and grow. And these are the things that, you know, I think are part of the reflection of their own identities, or the part that I really want to interrogate. So the idea that, you know, their girls are singing songs that prime them to get ready for their own victimization is certainly part of it. But there's also another piece. There is the way in which the behaviors, the pain, the exploitation, the sexual victimization of black girls really floats under the radar for much of the public. And while we might see girls engaged in commercial sexual exploitation or being victimized in some ways, there's this tendency, given the legacy and stereotyping associated with black sexuality, black feminine sexual expressions especially, that says, okay, these girls are choosing to participate in this life, right? These girls aren't trafficked. That happens on the global sphere. That doesn't happen domestically. And so I'm challenging that because these girls are absolutely trafficked, and they are not choosing to participate in this life, and they are trying the best they can to really reconcile many oppressions that invade their lives and strip away their childhoods. And in schools, we tend to see them show up primarily as truants and, you know, sort of engage them as if they are rule breakers and violators of law, instead of engaging with them at the point of their victimization status. And that's the piece that I want to, you know, really uplift and engage as we talk about the particular vulnerabilities of girls who are pushed out. And I include them here not as a niche population. I include them here pretty centrally because girls who have a history of sexual victimization, commercial exploitation, these girls are at highest risk of school pushout. And, you know, our failure to address their needs is associated with our failure to address school pushout, and especially among girls who are at high risk.
Yeah, I mean, the whole notion that an 11, 12, 13, or 14-year-old could even choose to do this,
even if
they think they... and, you know, you imagine if these were white girls, or even, not even white middle-class girls, but white girls, there would be an uproar.
Right. And, you know, really thinking about, you know, our girls not as throwaway children. I don't believe in throwaway children. I've said that in many different spaces, and in many ways, these girls have been our forgotten daughters. We, you know, see them in passing, or we just kind of disregard them as not wanting to participate, and it's a really irresponsible way that we have engaged them, especially when you think about schools as mandatory reporting agencies. And, you know, our failure to respond to them is really just unconscionable. So, in that sense, they are center. they are center to this work to me.
You also go into policies that contribute to, that have greatly contributed to this push out of black girls from school, policies of zero tolerance, for example, and you link zero tolerance with a broken windows policing. So define the two of them and how they are linked.
Yeah, so the broken windows theory is really the philosophy in policing that if one addresses some of the smaller infractions, that they can prevent the larger infractions from occurring or the more serious offenses from occurring. And zero tolerance policies really grew out of a concern for public safety in schools that are really about removing students from schools based upon a set of predetermined mandatory actions that follow negative student behavior. In many ways, you know, the zero tolerance policies were designed to respond to the growing rates of violence that were being recorded in schools, largely associated with guns or drugs. But what has occurred, given the hyper-punitive nature of much of our discipline orientation over the past 20 years, is that kids who have, you know, engaged in behaviors that might have historically resulted in, you know, maybe a very serious discussion and intervention and dealing with root causes, now, you know, leads to their removal from school without any serious way of intervening or discussing what happens or resolving conflict in a meaningful way. Many schools are beginning to rethink their commitment to zero tolerance policies, given the growing body of research that has shown how little it actually has a positive impact on addressing student conflict. But there are still too many schools that do rely on zero tolerance policing, zero tolerance engagement with students, where there really is little to no room for students to make a mistake without being sent home or removed from school. This plays out in the life of girls in different ways. Number one, if girls are in a fight, in a physical altercation, they're often sent home on a mandatory suspension or a mandatory, you know, depending on the number of fights, expulsion, without there really being an interrogation of why these girls are engaged in the behaviors that they're engaged in. I don't in any way excuse the fighting that occurs, the physical violence that occurs in schools, but I'm also very clear that violence is something that we need to address together. And so when we talk about safety, I challenge the idea that safety is something that has to be implemented. In my mind, safety is co-constructed with the group that needs to be safe. And that means having conversations with girls about what is making them feel unsafe. So in the book, I uplift the narratives of girls who have been fighters, who are struggling, you know, with safety, and in some ways who have internalized the idea that they need to fight, quote unquote, in order to be safe in schools. And among those girls, when you dig a little deeper, of course you find that they are struggling with their own victimization, that they have learned that violence is the way that you respond to negative conflict, and that they feel that they're not listened to or heard in other ways. And, you know, it's interesting because in some of the early conversations that I was having with girls in the Northeast, we'd ask girls, I was in a focus group with a colleague of mine, Kimberly Crenshaw, who is a professor and scholar in these spaces around intersectionality, and she said, and we were sitting around a group of girls, and we recognized that not only did the girls have difficulty centering themselves in conversations about fighting in schools and school-to-confinement pathways, but that they, in many ways, were demonstrating and sharing that they felt they needed to act up and act, quote-unquote, like the boys if they were going to be seen and responded to, if their needs were going to be met by the school, that was the only way they could become visible was if they were fighting. And, you know, that to us, you know, just was jarring in so many ways to understand that one has to behave in a hyper-aggressive way in order to be seen is deeply problematic. And so that is, you know, again, why I spend so much time talking about the victimization of black girls and our inability to see it and respond to it outside of these spaces and the need for schools to do so in order for us to really move past some of the, you know, sort of, you know, very peripheral ways in which we're engaging with black girls at the moment.
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with Monique Morris about her terrific book, Push Out, The Criminalization of Black Girls in Schools. And I like your phrase, uplift their narrative, because you give the reader the perspective that in some ways, I mean, yeah, it may be inappropriate, it may be overblown, but in some ways it is within a tradition of black resistance to oppression.
Yeah, in some ways it very much is. You know, these girls in many ways are managing multiple oppressions, and they don't use that language, but I certainly see it. And what they do is just talk about fairness. And in their own words, they'll talk about feeling treated differently. They'll point to, you know, differential engagement. And, you know, I recognize these as structures of oppression and their resistance to it. So the practice, in particular, of speaking out when they feel something is wrong, or the tradition of challenging something that they feel is unjust, you know, it's really, you know, a way that they have come to understand their own particular voice. And then, you know, when they are engaged in the practice of doing it, they get into trouble again. And so that part for them in their young minds is very confusing. It's not particularly confusing to those of us who understand and study structures of oppression and understand that, you know, any act of resistance to oppression may be met with some alternate, you know, form of trying to suppress it. But at the same time, you know, for the girls who are trying to speak out and who are trying to learn how to be effective in their own spaces and navigate through these structures, you know, it can be very confusing and very disheartening. And so for many, they choose just not to come to school, and that quote-unquote choice is really a false one. It's one that is rooted in the adults pushing them away from school by not engaging them as whole people and as whole students. And so, you know, I think there are definitely ways that we can begin to respond to this and address the implicit and explicit ways in which our own adult biases are impacting young people's learning and development.
Talking about how adults relate to them, I mean, you have girls who were suspended for asking questions in class about the material.
I do, and it becomes worse when girls are in institutions. One of my biggest critiques about how we've come to understand and frame the quote-unquote school-to-prison pipeline is that we tend to assume that the engagement around punishment ends once kids are in prisons or in carceral facilities or in detention facilities. And so, you know, I went into some of the facilities to talk to girls about what their experiences were like. And, you know, in the chapter Learning on Lockdown, I talked to girls about the ways in which just raising their hands and asking a question can be seen as an affront to authority, that when girls do act in ways that respond to this, you know, negative reaction to their questioning, or when they respond in ways that make them feel justified in articulating their own ability to be in the classroom, that the punishment is even more severe. Because when we talk about suspensions outside of schools, the kids go home. But, you know, when kids are in detention facilities and we talk about suspensions, kids are placed in their rooms without an ability to go out for recreation, which is, in effect, solitary confinement. You know, we don't call it that, but really, you know, we've got to engage in our own reevaluation of how we are responding to the needs of girls, many of whom, again, have significant traumatic histories and experiences that require a different investment in their well-being. You know, certainly not putting them in solitary, certainly not telling them that they can't ask questions. To think that young people, particularly black girls, are discouraged from asking questions just feels to me completely inconsistent, not only with the norms of their communities, but, you know, certainly with the practice of learning and the engagement around the methods that we uplift so much in our, you know, public consciousness around this, the Socratic method, the ways of engaging and asking questions, posing and interrogating. All of these things are critical to our advancement.
Well, let's move on to some of the solutions. I was struck by when you do move to solutions in the final chapters, chapter of your book, you talk about the link between justice and love.
Yes. Love is at the center of all of this. You know, when I talk to people about what my policy recommendations are, I like to situate my recommendation that we lead with love as probably the most radical of all the opportunities to engage in this conversation, which is, you know, for some, you know, a bit counterintuitive to think about that, because it doesn't require money. It doesn't require, you know, any significant investment outside of our own shift in consciousness around these issues. And so, you know, what I'm talking about is largely about challenging the idea that we need to lead with a discipline-oriented structure in order to combat the negative student behavior that's occurring in schools. New research emerging out of Stanford around empathic discipline is, to me, extraordinarily promising, particularly when we're looking at how to reduce the number of students who are suspended and expelled from schools. The new data that were shared on empathic discipline, which is really about in responding to students with an idea that there are whole students who desire and need our empathy and need connections and relationships, that when teachers and educators respond to negative student behavior through an empathic lens, that really they're able to reduce the suspensions among Black and Latina girls by as much as 75%. So these are real solutions and ways of engaging that are healing informed, that are responding to the whole students, that are considering the past history of trauma and victimization in ways that can really do what we say our educational system is supposed to do, right? Which is educate our young people, prepare them to be successful adults and citizens in our communities. So, you know, the type of counseling, the, you know, healing-informed responses and climate development in schools, alongside the ability for us as adults to address our own biases and to develop curriculum that is both gender-responsive and culturally competent, that these are all real ways in which we can begin to address our expectations for young people's development, particularly for Black girls who are underserved disproportionately.
Isn't this also part of a larger shift in consciousness that's been brought to the front by the movement Black Lives Matter? You know, in other words, racism, it really means tackling racism head on, because so much of what you talk about here, well, racism and sexism, you know, the intersectionality of race, class, and gender, you know, is like a triple whammy that's coming down on the heads of these girls.
Yeah, I mean, I think many of us have been, you know, in the movement before the Black Lives Matter movement was underway, and I do believe that the full articulation and engagement of the public consciousness in this idea that Black lives are important to our development and that they should not be, or we should not be treated as secondary citizens, is critical to I think, an explosion of consciousness around these issues. You know, folks who have been in and out of facilities and who have been living under these conditions for a long time, you know, the Black Lives Matter, you know, is really a statement of love and a practice in the public domain, an uncompromising practice around understanding and appreciating the validity and value of Black lives. You know, I think that when we talk about school pushout and we talk about these issues, you're right that we are absolutely engaged in now the next phase of this understanding around Black lives, to understand that other identities, as fluid as they may be, around gender expression and identity, sexual expression and identity, socioeconomic status, are all also a part of the Black lives that matter. And so when we're talking about conditions and great phenomena like incarceration and criminalization, that it's important for us to explore all of the ways in which individuals are experiencing these systems and structures. You know, my own, you know, reaction to this issue is just that at no point do our girls, you know, stop being girls or Black or children, you know, and that, you know, when they walk through life, they're walking through life with these multiple identities that do, you know, present them with particular opportunities to engage the public, but also to navigate the public's gaze, which is often, you know, misunderstanding of their own identities and the ways that they express them. So, you know, I think this is all, to me, the beginning of what I hope will become a much more robust discussion about how we do combat sexism and patriarchy in our racial justice movements, and how our anti-sexism movements develop a stronger racial analysis, and how when we engage in conversations about equality and equity and transformation, you know, we're able to uplift all of these components and be as inclusive as possible as we're seeking to combat the exclusion that is preventing our girls from really being their best selves. So, you know, to that point, I do talk a bit about some of the things that I think need to be in place in the book, and, you know, spend some time in the appendices also responding to the common questions that I get, as well as, you know, the alternatives to punishment that are underway and the girls' own responses to that.
So just as a last thing, is there a comment from one of the girls that struck you the most and kind of is emblematic of this whole issue and the ways to solve it?
Well, there's one girl who talked a bit about how adults ask them to speak their minds, and then when they do, they get in trouble. And so for her, it leads back to the point that I was making earlier about how confusing this can be. But she said, "I'm just outspoken. They're always telling us to voice our opinions, but then when we voice our opinion, we're going to get in trouble." So that's irritating. And I think that they're just mad because I'm telling the truth, you know? That quote from her, to me, speaks to how important it is for our girls to speak their truth, and that whatever policy and practice recommendations we develop in response to these issues that I'm uplifting, that several other scholars and advocacy organizations are trying to combat, that the girls' own voices and truths need to be a part of that discussion. They need to be at the center. They need to be engaged as meaningful folks who are contributing to this development of solutions. And so, you know, that to me is, you know, I have often said that to be ignored is traumatic. And so when we don't engage the voices of young people, or we don't consider their unique experiences, critiques, and ideas about how to respond, we are contributing to that trauma.
Well, your book, Monique Morris, is just a terrific read and a very powerful exploration of something that really needs to be much, much greater in the public consciousness. Push Out, the Criminalization of Black Girls in Schools. Thanks so much for talking with us here.
Thank you for having me on.
That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Go to writersvoice.net to listen to or download past shows, plus find out more about our guests or read book excerpts. The Writer's Voice webmaster is Bill Way. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.